We are this evening in 1 Kings chapter 6. We have worked our way down to verse 7. On your own, if you are reading through these chapters, the parallel chapters are in 1 Chronicles chapter 28. Please look at your references in Chronicles. It gives us several other things that we don't have here. The temple itself, 90 foot long, 40 foot high, 45 foot high, 30 foot wide, not a huge building. Much smaller than our sanctuary. But remember, it wasn't built for the congregation of Israel to come inside and worship. We're used to this kind of a worship facility. It was built for the priests to go in and to come once a year before the Ark of the Covenant on Yom Kippur for the priests to officiate with the showbread, to light the candles, to light the incense. The congregation of Israel worshipped outside in the open in the temple courts there. So a smaller building than we would think. A divine blueprint. We're going to read that it took Solomon 7 years to build the temple and then 13 years to build his own house. And you might think, well, what kind of a guy is that? You know, the wisest man that ever lived doesn't sound very wise. He built God's house in 7 years and took 13 years to build his. Well, you have to be attentive to the fact that there were over 183,000 workmen working on the temple. There was 183,000 just involved in Lebanon to bring down timber and stone cutters and so forth. There were probably over 200,000 people involved for 7 years. And that helps to put it in perspective. I'm sure Solomon didn't have that many people building his home, his cedar palace in Lebanon. As we work through these first verses, we came down to verse 7 where it says, "And the house, when it was in building, was built of stone, made ready before it was brought there, so that there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in the building." So one of the remarkable scene as this temple is going up, it goes up in complete silence. There's not a sound. No sound of a tool, no sound of iron, no sound of a saw. I'm sure there was a sound now and then of the sliding of stone upon stone to put some of these blocks in places. But there's no sound of labor the way you and I would imagine this house quietly going up. The inhabitants of Jerusalem coming each day to see what had changed because it wasn't heard. It was observed in a remarkable way. Now it says in verse 8, and look, as we go through some of this, let me be honest. Some of this, I kind of have an idea of what it's saying, and some of it I don't. I won't let you know so you can actually be confident all the way through. In some of your Bible dictionaries and encyclopedias, there's some great renditions, at least to get an idea of, fairly accurate of the way the precincts looked and so forth. Not a sound is heard. Verse 8 says, "The door for the middle chamber was in the right side of the house, and they went up with a winding stairs into the middle chamber, out of the middle into the third." On the outside of the temple, there were the priest chambers, evidently on a second level with a winding staircase and a middle chamber. There's a particular chamber there for the priests. Verse 9 says, "So he built the house, and he finished it and covered the house with beams and boards of cedar. And then he built the chambers against all of the house, 5 cubits high, 7.5 foot high. They rested on the house with timbers of cedar. And the word of the Lord came to Solomon saying," now this is while construction is going on, God is speaking to Solomon, "concerning this house which thou art building. If thou wilt walk in my statutes and execute my judgments and keep all my commandments to walk in them, then will I perform my word with thee, which I spake unto David thy father." In the middle of the construction of this remarkable structure. God is speaking to Solomon and says, look, if your heart is right before me, if you walk before me in the commandments that I've given, then I'll fulfill everything I said to David. He's saying, Solomon, if you will keep my word, I will keep my word. And you know, I almost sense God in the middle of this, because the structure must be remarkable. The people of Jerusalem are coming to watch. Solomon is going to pray and dedicate this temple, and somehow God, it seems to me, is poking him, saying, Solomon, get your eyes off of this thing. Because still, in the middle of all of this, what I care about is the heart. What I care about is your attitude and your obedience. Don't ever think that because this structure is here, that there's something in that that is particularly pleasing to me. It will only be as the hearts of those who worship here are obedient and yielded and pliable that any of this means anything. Besides that, to God, it was wood, it was stone. Keep my judgments, my commandments, to walk in them. Then will I perform my word with thee, which I spake unto David thy father. And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people. So Solomon built the house and finished it. And he built the walls of the house within with boards of cedar, both the floor of the house and the walls of the ceiling, and he covered them on the inside with wood, and covered the floor of the house with planks of fir. And he built 20 cubits on the sides of the house, both the floor and the walls with the boards of cedar. He even built them for it within, even for the oracle. Now this is the even for the most holy place. The Holy of Holies is a 20-foot cube in the middle of this temple that's 45 foot high, 30 foot wide. In the middle of it, on the far end, there is a 20 by 20 foot cubicle. Now, he builds it all of stone, and then he lines the inside, the walls and the ceiling with cedar, the floor with fir, which is probably a cypress, that is pretty much impervious to wear and rot and so forth. And then he builds within that this structure that is 20 foot square, 20 cubits square, a cube. And all of these measurements, again, exactly double the tabernacle. That was 10 cubits there, the Holy of Holies. This is 20 foot. And the house that is the temple before it, the holy place, was 40 cubits long. And the cedar of the house within was carved with knops, or gourds with open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone seen. And the oracle, the Holy of Holies, he prepared in the house within to set there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. So lining the inside with cedar and cypress so that no stone is seen, and then carving the cedar with gourds and with leaves and with flowers, and all of that's going to be overlaid with gold. We're going to see that as this goes on. And the oracle in the forepart was 20 cubits in length and 20 cubits in breadth and 20 cubits in the height thereof, and he overlaid it with pure gold and so covered the altar, which was of cedar. Now, overlaying it with pure gold, it's a cube, 20 cubits, 20 cubits, 20. You know, it's interesting as we look at this, because the holy city, Jerusalem, in the book of Revelation, some try to make that a triangle. Obviously, it is the Holy of Holies forever, and it is 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles, a cube also. A square, and the streets are made of pure gold as clear as glass, and the walls are made of jewels. Here, all of this looking forward to a greater truth. You can try to figure out as we go through this, and you'll let me know next week if you want to, whatever the going price of gold is this week. There was in this house, by most estimates, about 75,000 pounds of gold, 37 and a half tons of gold to overlay the interior of this temple. And then we're going to find there's precious stones embedded in that gold, and they feel that the precious stones may actually have been worth more than the gold itself. So one of you, do me a favor this week, figure out today's price, market price, with 37 and a half tons of 24 karat gold, or the purest gold we have today, is in market value today. Let me know next week, and I'll let everybody else know. Don't shout it out. Come up to me and give it to me on a card, or let us know. So Solomon overlaid the house within with pure gold. And he made, now we're going to, as we move on, we're going to find out, Second Chronicles tells us that there are 10 lampstands in there. Remember, there are some things that differ from the tabernacle. Remember in the tabernacle, when you came in, on the left-hand side was the menorah, on the right-hand side was the table of showbread. When you come into the temple, there are 10 lampstands. So all of that would illuminate in there. If the walls are made of pure gold, purer than 24 karat pure gold, overlaid all of this cedar over all these flowers and so forth, and then there are precious stones set in that, and then you put 10 lampstands in there burning oil, you can imagine the light that reflected, the aura, the glow that was in there when those priests went in to administer the things of the Lord in there. Solomon overlaid the house within with pure gold, and he made a partition by the chains of gold before the oracle, and overlaid it with gold. And the whole house he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the house. Also the whole altar that was by the oracle he overlaid with gold, the altar of incense. And within the oracle he made two cherubims of olive tree, of olive wood, each of them 10 cubits high, 15 foot high. 5 cubits was the one wing, 7.5 foot of the cherub, and 5 cubits was the other wing of the cherub, from the uttermost part of the one wing unto the uttermost part of the other wing. It was 10 cubits, 15 foot. And the other cherub, it's going to tell us exactly the same, was 10 cubits. Both cherubim were of one measure and one size. The height of the one cherub was 10 cubits, so was that of the other cherub, 15 foot high. And he set the cherubim within the inner house, the Holy of Holies. They stretched forth the wings of the cherubim so that the wing of one touched the wing of one wall, and the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched one another in the midst of the house. And he overlaid the cherubims with gold. Now only the priest would see these. Inside this Holy of Holies, they carved these two cherubim by God's design, 15 foot tall. Their wings stretched out 15 foot across, so they're touching the walls on both sides, and evidently the front of the wings touching each other, and he overlays them with pure gold. Now remember, the cherubim have the face of a man, the face of an ox, the face of an eagle, and the face of a lion. And we're introduced in the cherubim in the Garden of Eden as God drives Adam and Eve out of the garden. It says he puts a cherub with a flaming sword to guard the way to the tree of life. But of course, they don't partake of it in a fallen nature and then live forever in a fallen state. And we follow that pattern. When God makes the tabernacle, he hangs that cloth there with the cherubim embroidered on it, separating the holy place from the Holy of Holies. A picture again of Eden, of man's, you know, quest to return to open fellowship with God, and the fact that those cherubim are standing there guarding the way. As we look now at this scene, we find them not only in the Holy of Holies, but again, they're going to be on embroidered on the temple. And we're told that in Herod's temple, the veil there, 80 foot high, woven 10 to 12 inches thick, with these huge cherubim embroidered on there. But that when Jesus died on the cross, it says that veil was torn from the top to the bottom. Not from the bottom to the top, from the top to the bottom. And those cherubim, as it were pushed out of the way so that you and I, through the blood of Christ, can have open fellowship with the living God again, like Adam did in Eden. No priest need be between us, no pastor, no human being. The cross of Christ opened the way for each one of us. God has no grandchildren, only sons and daughters, so that we can come directly in contact with him. Early church understood, you know, we see in the four Gospels, remarkably, Matthew portrays Jesus as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Mark portrays Christ as the suffering servant, the ox. Luke portrays Jesus in his humanity, the man. John portrays Christ in his deity, the eagle. The early church understood there were places where they met in secret, where the ichthus, the fish, would be carved on the wall. And some of the things that marked where they would meet would be the four faces of the cherubim, because the early church knew that those faces were reflected in the four gospels. Interesting, when you look down on the encampment of Israel, the four flags that were on the far corners of the four tribes that were the furthest from the tabernacle itself, on their flags was the face of a man, the face of a lion, in the face of an ox, in the face of an eagle. Again, the picture of God overseeing and watching over his people. So remarkable. I don't know what it must have been like to go in there. Only the high priest got to go in once a year with the blood of the lamb. But just imagine entering into the Holy of Holies and these two 15-foot, imagine just as high as the ceiling, two 15-foot golden cherubim standing over top of you looking down. I'd be glad to get out of there. Amazing scene, overlaid with gold. And he carved all the walls of the house round about with carved figures of cherubims, of palm trees, of open flowers within and without. And the floor of the house he overlaid with gold. The floor overlaid with gold within and without. And for the entering of the oracle, he made doors of the olive tree, entering into the holy place, not the most holy place. There were doors that entered in there, and he tells us about them, the side posts. Now, you can see in your own mind, if you can figure out what this is, because I read a number of scholars, and they don't agree. So let me read it to you. For the entering in of the oracle, he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and the side posts were a fifth part of the wall. The two doors were also of olive wood, and he carved upon them carvings of cherubim and palm trees, open flowers, overlaid them with gold, and spread gold upon the cherubim and upon the palm trees. So also made he for the door of the temple post of olive wood a fourth part of the wall. Now, you got that down so far? And the two doors were of fir or cypress, and the two leaves of the one door were folding. We know we got folding doors here. And the two leaves of the other door were folding. Now, it seems that these big doors, that there's two doors that fold in the middle, it seems. It's hard to know exactly the way this is written. And he carved thereon cherubims and palm trees, open flowers, covered them with gold fitted with carved work. And he built the inner court with three rows of huge stone and a row of cedar beams. And in the fourth year was the foundation of the house of the Lord laid, in the month of Ziph, April, May, the spring. That's the fourth year. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bull, October, November, which is in the 8th month, was the house finished throughout all the parts thereof. And according to all the fashion of it, so was he, Solomon, 7 years in building it. And that doesn't surprise me. Seven, a number of completion, of perfection in the scripture. 7 years building this house. Now, King James says, but Solomon was building his own house 13 years. Now, I don't know if there's a hidden reproof here of this man who ultimately, in his luxury and his wealth, would turn away from the living God and worship other gods. But he was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all of his house, maybe building at the same time, no doubt a smaller workforce. He built also the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now, this is the place I think I would like to have lived. The length thereof, I wouldn't need a house this big, just a cedar apartment would be fine, but the length thereof is 100 cubits, 150 foot long. Now, this is the house, 150 foot long, the breadth of it, 75 foot, and the height of it 45 foot. This is a nice pad. It's a nice cabin in the mountains in Lebanon, built out of cedar, 150 foot long, 75 foot wide, 45 foot high. Four rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams upon the pillars, and it was covered with cedar above, upon the beams that lay on 45 pillars, 15 in a row. So 3 rows of 15 pillars, all made of cedar. You guys know the way cedar is. You know, your parents, they all had a cedar closet or a cedar chest. Imagine living inside of there. And there were windows in 3 rows. And I'll read this. And light was against light in 3 ranks. Come on, help us, Solomon. You're the wisest man that ever lived. Can you just give this to this? Give us a glossary here or something. And all the doors and the posts were square with the windows, and light was against light in 3 ranks. We knew that. And he made a porch of pillars. Okay, I can dig a porch. The length thereof was 50 cubits, 75 foot, and the breadth thereof was 30 cubits. And the porch, that's 45 foot, and the porch was before them, and the other pillars and the thick beam were before them. So, beautiful house of state, seems to have a giant porch outside. Imagine being that up in the mountains and the cedars of Lebanon. Again, some of these cedar trees, 130 to 140 foot tall then. Botanists estimate that they were 2,000 to 3,000 years old. And there are still cedars up there that they estimate are over 2,000 years old. And they're incredible. Have you ever seen photographs of them? What a remarkable tree. You know, the depressing thing for me is I like trees. I'm not a tree hugger, don't get me wrong. I just planted some redwoods on my front lawn, and they're not California redwoods, they're dawn redwoods, but they'll get 130 foot tall in 60 or 70 years. So I won't see it. I plan to be raptured long before that. And then you plant trees and work on the garden, and it says in the book of Revelation, all the green grass and the trees are going to be burned up. It's a little futile. One thing I'll enjoy about the millennium is watching a cedar tree grow for 1,000 years. Enjoying that. Sorry, I think about these things. Then he made a porch for the throne where he might judge. Even the porch of judgment, it was covered with cedar from one side of the floor to the other. And his house, where he dwelt, had another court within the porch, which was of the like work. Solomon made also a house for Pharaoh's daughter. Now, she must have been beautiful. He built her own house, whom he had taken to wife, like unto this porch. He made her own, either her own porch on one side of the palace or her own house. It's hard to tell. All these were of costly stones, so we're back at Jerusalem now, according to the measures of huge stones, sawed with saws within and without, even from the foundation unto the coping, and so on the outside towards the great court. Got it all down. And the foundation was of costly stones, even great stones. Now listen, stones of 10 cubits, 15 foot by 8 cubits, 12 foot. The foundations were stones 15 foot by 12 foot. You hear that? The foundation stones were 15 foot by 12 foot. 15 foot's as tall as the ceiling. These are the foundation stones, 15 foot high and 12 foot wide. How did they move those stones? He had to be the wisest guy on earth just to build the foundation to his house. Imagine these stones. You know, again, you go to Jerusalem today and some of Herod's stones are there that are 20 foot long and 5 foot thick and 8 foot across. Remarkable. There are several that are over 100 tons. And you just look at them and it's a wonder how they move those things. You know, I think that people have gotten dumber over the centuries. No offense. I know that some of you are much smarter than me. I'm the dumb of the dumb, and that's okay with me. He uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and I'm a confounder. But when you look back to ancient Egypt, you look back to some of the things that were built then, you look at the measurements, you look at the exactness, you know, when you look at the Great Pyramid in Giza, 250, over 3 million stones, most of them 25 tons apiece, with less tolerance between the stones than we have on the tiles on the space shuttle. This is a remarkable thing. Closer to Adam, I think the gene pool was purer. Over the years, we've gotten dumber. My theory. We have the benefit of years of technology building, of course, but less brain power to use it. So here we are, the dumbest generation that ever lived, with the most powerful weapons any generation has ever had. That's bad. Stones 15 foot by 12 foot as foundation stones. And above were costly stones, after the measures of huge stones and cedar. And the great court round about was with three rows of huge stones and a row of cedar beams, both for the inner court of the house of the Lord and for the porch of the house. And King Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. Now this is not King Hiram, because we're going to find out this is a widow's son. He's an artisan. He is a craftsman. King Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali. And his father was a man of Tyre, a workman in brass. Now, God using the compromise of some woman from Naphtali that married a Gentile from Tyre. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning to work all works in brass. And he came to King Solomon and wrought all of his work. For he cast, now listen to this, and just think how long ago this is. He cast two pillars of brass of 18 cubits high. They were 24 foot high, these pillars of brass. And the line, the circumference, 12 cubits, 6 foot in diameter. Did compass either of them. So he casts these two brass pillars. He casts them. He makes a cast and does this work in brass. 24 foot high, 6 foot in diameter, these two huge brass pillars. And he made two catheters, two basins of molten brass to set upon the two tops of the pillars. The height of the one catheter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other catheter was 5 cubits, so 7.5 foot. These are over 30 foot tall now. And they're not supporting the building. These are two huge brass pillars out in front of the temple that are over 30 foot high, that have two huge oil basins on the top that are lit. And there are these two incredible, beautiful brass pillars with a flame on top to light the whole precinct of the temple building and of the temple courts, like two huge, you know, lamps standing out there in front of the temple. How remarkable that they could even cast these things in those days. And the nets of checker work. There were checker works and wreath works all around the top of the catheters of these basins. It tells us how beautiful they were. Upon the pillars, 7 for the one catheter, 7 for the other catheter, these intricate carvings around the top. He made the pillars and the two rows round about on the upon the one network to cover the catheters. Just, we can read it. That were upon the top, pomegranates, so did he on the other catheter. And the catheters, the big basins on top that are 7.5 foot high, that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work, flowers, in the porch, 4 cubits. And the catheters upon the two pillars had pomegranates also above, over against the belly, come on Solomon, which was by the network. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the top of the capiter. So we're trying to figure out here, there's these 24-foot pillars with all kinds of intricate work, a netting work around them, and then these two 7.5-foot basins, these capiters on top, with 240 pomegranates around the top of each one, because they're at least 6 foot across in diameter, and all of this lily work and flowers all around the edge, and then they're set on fire to light the precincts of the temple. And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple. Now, these are different than the two brass pillars. These are the two pillars that actually support the front of the temple. He set up the two pillars in the porch of the temple. He set up the right pillar and called the name thereof Jacinth, which means to establish. And he set up the left pillar. Upon it, he called the name thereof Boaz. And upon the top of the pillars, the lily work, so was the work of the pillars finished. So if you look out in front of the church when you come in sometime, the two pillars out front say Boaz and Jacinth on them to establish and strengthen. And of course, it's our prayer that as God's people come and worship here, that they will be established and strengthened. And he made a molten sea, 10 cubits, from the one brim to the other. Now, this molten sea, we're going to see, is a big bowl made of brass. It's 15 foot across, and it's a hand breadth thick. So the brass itself is from my thumb to my forefinger. That's how thick it is, this big basin of brass. He made a molten sea, 10 cubits from the one brim to the other. It was round all about, and its height was 5 cubits, 7.5 foot high. And the line, the circumference, was 30 cubits. Did it compass round about? Would hold about 15,000 gallons of water, these measurements. Under the brim and round about, there were knops, gourds, compassing it. 10 in a cubit compassing the sea, round about 10 gourds per cubit, going for 18 inches going around the outside. The knops were cast in two rows when it was cast, so they're all made as part of it. And it stood upon 12 oxen. I have a remarkable artist's rendition of this. Three looking towards the north, three looking towards the west, three looking towards the south, and three looking towards the east. And the sea was set above them, and all their hind parts were inward. So this huge brass basin that is this thick in its thickness and 10 foot across, over 30 foot around, 7.5 foot high, holding 15,000 gallons of water, and underneath there's 12 oxen, three facing in each direction with their hind parts under, holding it up, and sticking out from under the side this their heads and their horns. So just what a remarkable thing. And, you know, this is thousands of years ago. This guy's casting these things. I'm thinking, how? And he made, and I'm not going to torture you with this, beginning of verse 27. I'll tell you what it says down to verse 37. And he made 10 bases of brass. They seem to be slaughtering tables. There are 10 of them. 5 of them will go on one side of the temple. 5 of them will go on the other side of the temple. They seem to be about 5 foot square on the top, and they seem each of them to have a basin attached to it for washing, but they seem to be tables for the slaughtering of sacrifices before they would be put actually upon the altar, from what we can figure. So from verse 27 down to 37, aren't you relieved? That's what it describes for us. And then the lavers, verse 38, which are attached to them, the bases that contained water. Verse 40 says this, and Hiram made the lavers, now it's going to describe out of brass all of these implements. He made the lavers, the shovels, the basins. So Hiram made an end of doing all the work that he made King Solomon for the house of the Lord. To the two pillars, the two bowls and the catheters that were on top of the two pillars, the two networks that covered the bowls and goes on that were upon the top of the pillars, 400 pomegranates for the two networks, the two rows of pomegranates, goes on and on, 10 bases, verse 43, 10 lavers, and the one sea and the 12 oxen under the sea. Verse 45, and the pots and the shovels and the basins and all of these vessels Hiram made to King Solomon for the house of the Lord. They were of bright brass. In the plain of Jordan did the king cast them. So somewhere down by the Jordan River, in the plain, in the flatland down there, they set up some casting smelting place. It was down there where he cast them all in the clay in the ground between Succoth and Zarethan. And Solomon left all the vessels, notice this, unweighed, because they were exceedingly many, neither was the weight of the brass ever found out. So much weight in brass, the Holy Spirit says, after giving us all of these measurements and all of these cubits and all the, it finally comes to the end of this portion, and the Holy Spirit says, Solomon never bothered to weigh, although there was so much weight in brass that even to this day, we never really figured it out. And Solomon made all the vessels that pertained unto the house of the Lord, the altar of gold, table of incense, the table of gold whereupon the showbread was, the candlesticks, the lampstands, not candlesticks, they're lampstands, of pure gold, five on the right side, five on the left, before the oracle, with the flowers and the lamps and the tongues and the bowls and the snuffers and the basins and the spoons and the censers and the hinges and the doors and the house and the most holy place and the doors of the house, all of these things covered with gold or being made of gold. So was ended all the work that King Solomon made for the house of the Lord. And Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, even the silver and the gold, and the vessels that he put among the treasures of the house of the Lord. Now, next week I'll bring one of these pictures, and we'll just leave it up here. So if you're still coming to church on Sunday nights next week, you can come up and look through an artist's rendition with the bronze laver with the bulls under it and the two pillars out in front of the temple. It's a remarkable scene, really. All of the furnishings now, the temple done, about to be dedicated. What still has to take place is the Ark of the Covenant has to be put in place. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is in Zion. Solomon on his throne, Yahweh in his house, the wanderings of Israel over, David having subdued all of the enemies of Israel. This scene really brings Israel to its apex in regards to glory and power in an earthly kingdom. Verse 2 says, and all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast. Now, this is the Feast of Tabernacles in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month, which is the seventh month. Now, which the Feast of Tabernacles is celebrated, remembering the wilderness wanderings and looking forward to, you know, this scene itself. God putting an end to their wanderings, God sustaining them in their wanderings. And imagine this tabernacle, all of the places it had gone since it was made in the wilderness by Moses and the craftsmen, all of the miles it was carried, the parting of the Jordan River, the tabernacle, the remarkable scenes, and now finally being brought to this place. God said, when you come into the land, there's a place where I will set my name there. All of that being realized now. And I can't imagine the emotion of those who were spiritually minded, who were there, who would have appreciated what was taking place. All of the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. And they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tabernacle of the congregation and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, even those that the priests and the Levites bring up. And King Solomon and all of the congregation of Israel, probably over 1 million people, that were assembled unto him, were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. That's the animals being sacrificed. And the priest brought in the ark of the covenant of the Lord into his place, into the oracle of the house, the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubims. For the cherubim spread forth their two wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark and the staves thereof above. And just imagine now, they bring in the Ark of the Covenant into this place, and they actually place it under, on the mercy seat itself, on the cover of the Ark, there are smaller cherubim. Now they place all of that under these huge cherubim, covered with gold, with their wings spread out. It says they set the Ark in place. It says in verse 8, they drew out the staves, that the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without. Just, they said they drew out the staves, and remember, no one was allowed to touch the ark, the poles that they carried the ark with, and they laid them down on the floor and just pushed them so that the ends of the poles stuck out underneath the curtain so that they could see the staves were on the ground and the ark was in his resting place. And they were not seen without. They are, and there they are unto this day. That's unto the day that this is written. And there was nothing in the ark in those days except the two tables of stone which Moses put there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. Now, we don't know what happened to the golden bowl of manna that was in there. Maybe it, when it was in the land of the Philistines, when it came to Beth Shemesh, you remember the men uncovered it and looked into it and were smitten with a plague. Aaron's rod that budded had been inside. The golden bowl of manna had been inside and the two tables of stone. Now, by this time, all that's left in the Ark of the Covenant is the two tables of stone. I certainly wouldn't minimize those. The handwriting of God upon them, the finger of God having written the law on those two tables. Interesting. It would be an interesting archaeological find to find the Ark of the Covenant. All kinds of theories. You certainly know the ones where they say that it's in Ethiopia, the Ark of the Covenant. And there are those who trace out the legitimacy of that. There are those not, within the last 5-6 years, through satellite photography, that have identified down in the area of Qumran, a cave that still is not opened, where they believe they've seen, and by the density of thermal photography, a gold box in one of those caves. There is tradition that Jeremiah hid it in a cave in Pisgah, over in the area of Moab today. There is another tradition with some substantiation that the Ark of the Covenant is in the basement of the Vatican. When Titus Vespasian came back from Jerusalem after his victory there, the Arch of Titus in Rome has a relief of him coming with all of the spoil from Jerusalem. And you can clearly see the table of showbread and the menorah. And there's a third object that's partly broken off and you can't tell what it is, that some scholars feel is the Ark of the Covenant. And that the church had never given it back to. Now, around 606 B.C., there was given to what was just called the Church of Jerusalem at that time, the table of incense and the menorah, or the table of showbread and the menorah, were given to the church in Jerusalem, and then that was carried off by Muslims and probably ground to powder. But the question is it in the basement of the Vatican? I don't know. I've talked to rabbis in Jerusalem at the Temple Institute who say that in 67 they went under the Temple Mount, and if you go the Rabbi's Tunnel now, you'll see one part of the wall in the base of the temple, and I've been there many times, that's all blocked up with concrete. And Shlomo Goren and another one of the major rabbis in Israel said that they went under the Temple Mount and saw the Ark of the Covenant, that they know where it's hidden. And they're not ready to pull it out because it'll start a holy war until the right time. So there are those who tell those stories. I don't know where it is. I'd sure like to see it. Here, back to our story. There's nothing in the ark, verse 9, except the two tables of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb, when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel, when they came out of the land of Egypt. Would be remarkable to see those tablets of stone, wouldn't it? And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So they take the Ark of the Covenant, they put it in the Holy of Holies, no doubt then drawing the veil, the ends of the staves sticking out, signifying that the Ark is in its resting place. As the priests are leaving the temple, the Shekinah glory of God comes and fills the temple. It says the glory of the Lord is so intense that the priest couldn't stand. No one could enter. Now just try to imagine what this looks like. When the glory of the Lord appears to Saul on the road of Damascus, he can't see. He's blinded by the light. It tells us God dwells in unapproachable light. Just imagine what it was like. Floor covered with pure gold. Walls, ceilings, all covered with pure gold. Precious gems embedded all over in that gold. And then turn on the brightest light you could ever imagine in the middle of that. And I'm sure the light was shining out the front door of the temple like a flashlight. It must have went boom, and this big beam of light must have been just coming out the front. Everybody hit the deck. Nobody could stand. God inhabiting. And of course, the remarkable prayers will be, God, the heavens themselves can't contain thee. You don't need a temple made with stone and with gold to dwell in. These things can't contain thee. We'll hear Solomon in all of his wisdom. Now, the interesting thing is this. Look at all the intricacy of this. Look at, and somebody's going to tell me what 37 and a half tons of gold is worth. Look at 200,000 men working for 7 years. Look at the most intricate buildings you can imagine in this world. Trump Plaza. Look at the buildings down. What are they for? For gambling. You know, think of some of the most extravagant buildings in this world. None of them compare to this. And what this is a slaughtering place. It's a slaughtering place. With all of its intricacy and value and beauty, it's a place to come and cut the throat of a lamb and to watch the blood of an innocent substitute be poured out in the place of the worshiper. It's a place for people like you and I to come with a sin offering when we've done something wrong. With a trespass offering when we've broken God's law. With a fellowship offering when we feel like we need to draw close to God. With a burnt offering when we're saying for the 19th million time, Lord, I really consecrate my life to you now. It was a slaughtering place, a place of worship. place for God's people to come in all of their infirmity and in all of their failings and all of their sin and weakness. It was a place to come, divinely appointed, divinely filled, a place for blood to flow. And remarkably, what it looked forward to was a wooden cross without the gate. No gold, no fanfare, no value. A wooden cross between two thieves outside the city. I've been to the Temple Mount at least 15 times. I love to go there. See the Jews worshiping. There's a beauty about it, a quietness about it. But I love to go to Golgotha. They have the top of Golgotha fenced off. You can't get up there now, thanks to Moody. When he went to Jerusalem, he was so inspired, he climbed up on top of Golgotha and started to preach to the Muslims. They started a riot, got so mad, they fenced the top of it off. We can't go up there anymore. And they built a bus station in front of it, which ruins the ambiance. But around the backside, there's a garden where the garden tomb is. And every time I go there, it amazes me to look up on the top of that hill and think that 2,000 years ago, all of my sins ran down into the ground with the blood of Christ. That my life was paid for there. Years. Slaughtering place. That's what worship is all about. That's what it costs God to make us his own. That's what it costs God for the person next to you. I hope you love them and pray for them. Hope you never think you're better than they are. You didn't need that blood any less than the person next to you.